This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhead of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time or by going to our website, thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen live to our past shows on our iPod Ready Archive section. That's www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. Now, if you have a Nokia phone, you can also listen live via satellite. Just go to the website for details. I'm very honored and pleased to have with us tonight a wonderful human being, Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb. Rabbi Gottlieb was one of the first 10 women to become a rabbi in Jewish history. Rabbi Lynn has served as a rabbi for the past 32 years, but that's not all there is to this woman. She's an amazing woman. I could go on for probably the better part of the show just telling you what some of her credits are, but she is a professional storyteller, a puppeteer, author, and percussionist with the Rebbe's Orchestra, as well as one of the few trained klezmer dancers in the United States, and we're going to have to talk to you about that, Rabbi. She's performed original work at the Public Theater in New York City, the Mark Tapper Forum, and hundreds of venues throughout the United States, Europe, Canada, and Israel for the past 30 years. Her work has been hailed as breathtaking and visionary. In her most recent work, Play with Borders, her voices reflected Israel and Palestine, opens the door to a heartfelt dialogue. Hello, Rabbi Lynn. Thank you for joining us this evening.
Shalom Aleichem and Shalom Aleichem. It's good to be here. Thank you. And it's 36 years now that I've been.
Wow. Okay.
Been
there. We're going to have to update your bios there. One of 10 women rabbis. First of all, congratulations. And, Rabbi, you were ordained under the auspices of the Jewish Renewal Movement. What is that, the Jewish Renewal Movement?
When I was ordained, the Jewish Renewal Movement did not have a formalized name, but it evolved into a formal movement with a rabbinic school and a rabbinical organization and many congregations, over 50 congregations throughout the United States. And the movement arose in the late 60s, early 70s. It said that every generation has to write its own Torah, and the Torah of that generation and ongoing generations was about the integration of several new contemporary movements into Jewish life, and that would include human rights and civil rights movement, the environmental movement, feminism, more sensitivity to multi-faith efforts, as well as looking back and embracing some of the texts around the mystical tradition, the Kabbalah, and looking how they apply to contemporary spirituality. So that's it in a nutshell, I guess.
In a nutshell, wow. Writing, each generation must write a new Torah.
That is symbolizes or represents the idea that the tradition is dynamic and that we have to look at the tradition from the perspective of the needs of our own time as we try to carry it forward and honor it.
I see. Very interesting. I had never heard that before. That's fascinating. Let me ask you.
It's actually one of the things I think that allowed women to become rabbis so quickly in Jewish history. When the issue finally arose, It was mediated within approximately 50 years. And the readiness of the community to receive women in part comes from that sense of dynamism that people regard the tradition with.
Well, as a dynamic movement, they literally consider it a live tradition, correct?
That's right. A living tradition.
A living tradition, very interesting. Can you tell me, Rabbi Lynn, what issues have arisen from such a distinction? I can't imagine that everybody embraced you as well as you would probably have liked.
Well, there actually has been very widespread support. Of course, there, you know, and it's been 36 years, and now there's almost 1,000 women, perhaps 1,000 women, who are serving as rabbis within the framework of Judaism. And that all came about fairly quickly once it started to move. So, it's part of the, let's say, the larger question of human rights for women globally and the leadership positions women seek to take. And, of course, there's tension between cultural innovation and contemporary revelations, you might say, and traditional perspectives. So negotiating that tension still exists, of course, and some parts of the Jewish community have not accepted women as rabbis.
And how do you reconcile that?
It is what it is. I mean, well, you just you work with what the situation is, and build. You know, I would say probably 80% of the Jewish community recognizes women as rabbis. So it's a pretty large percentage.
So it isn't something that you have to battle your way through.
Not too much anymore, no.
The congregation
in Israel, it's a slightly different situation. In the United States and Canada, I'll say in North America, it's not as much of a challenge as it still is in Israel and in other parts of Europe. And Australia, there are also women rabbis as well. So there are different places in the globe which the struggle is a little more pronounced than in North America.
So actually you probably have more, you're saying that there are more issues in Israel as opposed to here in the United States. Do you think the majority of female rabbis in the United States and outside of Israel?
The majority of rabbis are in the United States, yes.
Okay, very interesting. Very interesting.
Although there are rabbis in women rabbis in Canada and in Europe, Australia, and Israel as well. There's at least approximately 30 women who are practicing as rabbis in Israel, at least. There could be more. I need to update my knowledge about exactly how many there are.
Very interesting. Congregation Nachlat Shalom in Albuquerque is a Jewish community devoted to education, the arts, and peacemaking. Peacemaking. Can you explain what, where, and with who you are trying to make peace?
Well, since my bio wasn't updated, I'd love to speak about peacemaking. Peacemaking is been part of my work for the last 40 years, and it's been a lifelong passion. And I am now the Rabbi Emeritus at Congregation Nachlat Shalom, and I work for the American Friends Service Committee as a Middle East Program Associate in San Francisco in California. And I also serve a congregation in Toronto, Canada, that flies me in once a month, the Danforth Jewish Circle. Of course, I still have friends and return frequently, not so frequently as I would like, to to New Mexico. The peace work that with which I'm engaged is manyfold. One is working on multi-faith understanding, in particular multi-faith understanding and solidarity between Jews and Muslims in this last 5 years in particular, although that's been also a long-term interest and project of mine. Mm-hmm. Working on Jewish-Palestinian reconciliation, in particular Palestinian human rights, and looking at issues of racism and classism, economic justice, immigration rights have also been part of my peace work.
What is the Muslim-Jewish peace walk that you have engaged in?
Well, after 9/11, my community gathered, I mean, that Tuesday, and we sat in council, you might say. We passed a ritual object around the circle, and everyone, young and old, spoke about what was on their hearts and minds, just for a very brief period. But we wanted to hear from everybody, and about 100 people spoke. And it was clear that the community was very afraid that the result of 9/11 would be prejudice against Muslims and war against more innocent civilians. And so out of that, we began a process of discernment, trying to think of ways that we could promote a culture of peace. Out of that discernment grew the Muslim-Jewish Peace Walk. We were visited by the Myohji Buddhist Order, a peace walk order, that walks to give witness to the impact of nuclear industry on Native and Indigenous lands. And they stayed at our congregation. And we were very inspired by them, and we decided a month later to hold the first Muslim-Jewish Peace Walk, in which we walk from congregation Nahalat Shalom to the Islamic Center of New Mexico. And about 300 people showed up. We created kind of ritual style for it, everybody dressed in white, because that's both part of Muslim and Jewish ritual, as you know, to wear white for pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. And we carried signs that said peace, and we created a statement, and we were picked up by CNN and other communities really liked the idea. And at this current moment, there are ongoing peace walks with their own doing their own efforts in Philadelphia, Tucson, Vancouver, Toronto, Brooklyn, New York, and Albuquerque. So that was a very exciting effort.
Rabbi Lynn, are these peace walks held at a particular time during the year? Are they held to commemorate the 9/11 events? Or
each community chooses their own time, and because it is a walk and there are people walking on the streets from one religious institution, you know, to a series of religious institutions, and sometimes anywhere from 3 to 12 miles long, usually in the range of 3 or 4 miles, people pick the springtime or the early summertime or fall to walk. So it varies. It's usually when the weather is nice in a particular part of the country.
Well, peace is very important to you, and of course, you know, one of the biggest things that I think is on everyone's mind is the Israeli-Palestine issue. Many feel that this is the primary cause of dissension in the Middle East. Israel is in the process of getting ready to celebrate its 61st Independence Day in the next week or two. The Palestinians are commemorating the Nakba, which is the catastrophe. How can two nations see things so differently?
Yes, that's a really good question. And I think we if we, as North Americans, look at the impact of the Iraq War on Iraqis and think about Iraqi voices and Afghani voices that are so infrequently heard in our public space, we can begin to understand how two nations view history very differently. I think that it's important to know that there are many, many Jewish people in Israeli society and in the global Jewish community, just as there are North American activists who repudiate the culture of violence that we see being the culture of violence, which in the form of militarism and military occupation, which is plaguing the people of Palestine in Gaza and in the West Bank. And it's very difficult to speak about it and to find positive venues to talk about it, but I think we are seeing a growing movement that wants to hold the United States accountable for sending over $30 billion worth of weapons to Israel and therefore feeding the conflict. And some of the weapons are just horrendous, like white phosphorus and the dime bomb. And, you know, a lot of these weapons have made in the USA on them. So I think that American citizens should take more responsibility for our part in the perpetuation of so many conflicts around the globe through our support of militarism. And yes, this year, many of us throughout the Jewish world will be commemorating the Nakba along with the birth of the State of Israel. And it will be a day of Cheshbon HaNefesh, or soul-searching for us, because it's hard to celebrate such an occasion when we see what happened so recently to the people of Gaza. We have a tradition in Passover. I'm sorry, just one more little thing. I'm sorry. We have this tradition in Passover where we remove a drop of wine from one of our four cups in order, while we're saying the plagues. And, you know, this kind of indicates that when another people is suffering, you can't really be celebrating.
Well, that was one of my statements I was saying, is the catastrophe of another people caused by Israel cause for celebration. And I find that to be kind of... I just find that to be a very uncompassionate method of dealing with the issues. Obviously, many Israelis feel justified in celebratory methods, but again, the Nakba was caused by Israel. So here is this entire catastrophe of people being, as you said, in Gaza, the horrific events that happened there, the harnessing in of the Palestinians in that area in close quarters, denied even the most basic rights.
And it's still ongoing, of course.
It's just very unnerving to know that there is any reason to celebrate something like that. Let me ask you. You were harshly criticized.
Well, I would just say that for North Americans, we would do well to think the same thing on Thanksgiving and the 4th of July.
Amen.
But and just, you know, in that way, in some ways, to have also some compassion for finding ways to end the occupation and militarization without demonizing each other, which is very hard, and yet not, and to participate in the global effort to, you know, for boycott, for selective divestment, for sanctions, you know, to push harder on Congress and our representatives to hold hearings on the impact of weapons on U.S. on the impact of U.S. weapons on civilians in Gaza. And my colleague and I, Noura Khoury, and I, with the American Friends Service Committee in San Francisco, along with a coalition of a variety of groups, local congregations like the Buena Vista Methodist Church and Jewish Voice for Peace and Interfaith Peacebuilders of the FOR and other orgs, Break the Siege, we put on our own citizen hearings and listened to testimony from both civilians in Gaza, which was just heartbreaking, as well as Israeli resistors from the Shmini's team, high school students who are refusing to serve in the military, as well as people who went to Gaza, like Reem Salafi with the National Lawyers Guild, and some folks from Code Pink, to see for themselves and to document what happened. So all of these, you know, we don't have to just wring our hands. We can take action. We can be advocates for change.
Well, absolutely. And as Howard Zinn once said on our show, he said, do something, do anything, just don't do nothing. And I think that's key, because I think people throw up their hands sometimes and say, well, what good would it do? It would do a lot of good, if nothing more, as a Palestinian myself, Palestinian American, it helps to reestablish the faith in humanity for Palestinians that are either witnessing the suffering of their own people or the Palestinians that are on the ground suffering these horrific events. Sometimes you almost lose faith in humanity when you see. So if nothing more, these, the activism, the witness programs that go on in there, it really, really help to lighten the hearts of the Palestinian people, just for those that don't understand how part of that works. That's a huge part of it. Whether or not we can do it or not, or whether or not we can change the course of the events in the Middle East, I don't know. All I do know is that there is a people that's suffering, and when they know that there are people that care, it matters to them, and that's huge. You were harshly criticized by the Jewish community when you attended a United Nations event that Ahmadinejad spoke at, Rabbi Len. Can you talk to us about that a little bit?
Was I harshly criticized? I don't know. I also got a, received a really good article in the Jewish Week, actually. But yes, there are those who, well, Iran is another topic altogether, and there's a lot
that this is kind of a continuation of what is happening in the Middle East based on the events in Palestine. So, yeah, in a way it is different, and at the same time some people don't consider it very different. So I just wanted to hear your opinions on that.
Well, there is a connection, certainly, but especially because some in the Jewish community and in Israel have spoken about attacking Iran and so forth, and compared Ahmadinejad to Hitler and so forth. So, and then on vice versa, there's also a lot of demonization going on, Holocaust denial, and linking the two issues, which they're not really linked. So, and linking them is extremely problematic. Linking what's happening to Palestinians and the Holocaust is problematic. But so, for me as a peacemaker, when our governments aren't talking to each other, the U.S., and this was under the Bush administration, the United States, and the government of Iran, then it is a tradition in different peace organizations to engage in civilian diplomacy, which means that citizens, through non-governmental organizations, visit the enemy country, as it were, and begin to establish relationships with people, in this case Iran, who are interested also in reaching out. In this case, it was the Department of Interfaith, the Department of Interreligious Dialogue. So I went with the Fellowship of Reconciliation. I've been a member, you know, for most of my adult life of the FOR, and I've led many delegations with them to Palestine and Israel, and now to Iran. So I had already led one delegation to Iran and met many people there, really saw the country, the people living there, got to understand the culture a little bit, had a wonderful experience, and translated that experience into slideshows and wrote about it and so forth. So speaking at the interfaith meal in which Ahmadinejad was present was another, continuation of the idea of interfaith and civilian diplomacy, in which I was able to address sort of a Jewish position on nonviolence and on peacemaking in front of an audience of 250 people from various religious communities. So I thought it was very worthwhile.
Peace is better than war. That was a statement that you made. Do you believe that the social justice and peace can be had simultaneously?
Well, we also have a saying that without justice, peace is not fully realized. The concept of shalom or wholeness and well-being is understood to include the resolution of injustice in a community. So I think when we think about peace, we think about structural violence and systematic and categorical violence. Peace is a concept that occurs within the struggle for human rights. There can't be peace without the fulfillment of human rights.
Benjamin Netanyahu recently said that he would not even consider engaging in peace talks until the Palestinian government accepted Israel as a Jewish state. Now, that had never been presented as a concept before. Always, Israel has been presented as a democracy. And, in fact, I don't believe it to be a democracy. I believe that it is a theocracy based on the way the system is set up. Now, yes, they do have some democratic principles intact, but anytime everything falls according to the laws in Israel, everything falls by default to rabbinical law. Even in the peace talks that have been from Oslo on, one of the clauses in the peace negotiations is that the issues surrounding Jerusalem, and all of that will be resolved once the Mashiach returns.
Let me just finish
this one thing. Expecting Palestinians to now accept it not just as an Israeli state, but now as a Jewish state, is that a stretch, or is that just another way to avoid peace?
Well, let me respond in a couple ways. First of all, I wanted to say that the way that law exists in the Middle East, in Egypt, Jordan, Iran, Saudi Arabia, other countries, the religious community in all countries, including Israel, issues of personal status are in the hands of the clergy. Now, that is true throughout the Middle East, and in that regard, Israel is not different in the way that it handles questions of personal status.
Let me finish though.
It's not an apologetic, but I just want to make that clear, because that to me is a slightly different issue than the question of whether Israel is or is not a Jewish state, because that means that Jews are given, by definition, are given more privilege in certain arenas than are non-Jewish people. And we can see that that is, in fact, played out in various economic and other factors in Israeli society, where Jewish people have more access to health care, housing, water, resources, transportation, roads. So this this condition, one could call elements of structural violence, which of course we find in the United States as well, where you have, here you have more African Americans actually in jail than in college, African American men in jail than in college, which is a disgrace for this country. And we can look at Israeli society and see that there is discrimination against foreign laborers, as well. Many Southeast Asians are coming into the country. Then there is the larger issue, which of, in general, you know, since for the last 60 years, of the oppression of the Palestinian people and the effort to remove them from their traditional homelands and crowd them into smaller and smaller locations, and to rule over them with military rule, and to oppress them, you know, destroy houses, use administrative detention, torture, the uprooting of tens of thousands of olive trees, the destruction of over 24,145 homes since 1967, the killing of innocent civilians, the system of military checkpoints and barriers, the wall, and so forth and so on, a litany of aspects of occupation which are truly overwhelming and need all of our attention to, you know, to try to interrupt this by looking at the ways that the United States supports this occupation and turning our attention to Congress and creating a social movement, a grassroots social movement here that demands accountability. I think that's very important. So I guess that's how I would respond, you know.
Well, I certainly agree with you that accountability has to take place, and thank you for your truthfulness and your candor and the position of the treatment of citizens that are not of the Jewish faith within the borders and parameters or whatever that is of the Israeli state. My issue, though, is I see that, you know, you seem to be putting a lot of the burden of responsibility or the onus of responsibility on the American government and the American people. At the same time, many would suggest that they are an ally. What do you do? When does Israel get to take some responsibility for its own actions as an independent entity.
Absolutely. I think Israel has to take responsibility. There's no doubt. I can't tell you. It's just heartbreaking to me to see the community that I love investing generation after training generation after generation of its young people to be soldiers and to be oppressing another people. So that I hear testimony, as I did this past weekend, from a young man whose two brothers were murdered and one of them was intentionally allowed to bleed to death, a story I've heard countless times over the years of, so that it rises to an aspect of policy. While soldiers are eating chips or chocolate, you know, I mean, we know that young people cannot resist what soldiering does to them. We have heard Winter Soldier, soldiers coming back from Iraq. We've heard the testimony of young men in Africa who are hijacked and kidnapped into soldiering. We know our young people can become monsters if we allow them to soldier with impunity. And that is just what is happening in Israel, too. And we have to get a grip. Our community, the Jewish community, has to demand a change. And Israeli society does not yet have enough, but has young people who, of course, are refusing to go serve in the military and are instead choosing to go to jail. There's a movement of conscientious objectors, and we have to support them. You know, we have to find out about the Israelis within their own society who are resisting this and do what we can to support them as well, because they're also isolated and, you know, they have a hard time of it. And anyone who's worked on any social justice issue knows how hard it is to move the tide. You know, it's hard to move the tide. And so we have to look at what our positive resources are are helping to do that. And, yes, we're accountable.
Thank you. We're going to have to take a break right now, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll return with Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb in just a couple of minutes.
Are you appalled that our country is spending billions on war while cutting funds for our libraries, hospitals, and schools? Are you heartsick at the suffering of the Iraqi people? Then join me, Medea Benjamin, in signing Code Pink's urgent call for peace in Iraq. Sign on today at www.womensaynotowar.org.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
We used to write letters to each other a lot,
and it was intimidating to talk to him sometimes because he just seemed so isolated by himself.
She started talking about how she wishes that her life was over and she wishes that she was never born.
So I knew he had depression, but I didn't know it was that far.
Said something to me about killing himself.
Tell somebody, tell an adult, counselor, parent, whatever.
It's a hard situation because you do risk making that person very angry and losing their friendship.
It would have been horrible for me if she never talked to me again, but I'd live with it because I know she'd be alive.
Definitely worth getting help, even if you think you're going to lose a friendship, because it's better to lose the friendship than the actual friend.
Suicide is one of the leading causes of death among teens. For more information, contact the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, 888-333-AFSP, or online at afsp.org.
In our Constitution, the Founding Fathers laid a path to an economy that should have kept Americans free and prosperous. How we the people were tricked off that path into a world of debt and deception reads like one of the great mystery novels of all time. American Free Press compares author Ellen Brown's new book, Web of Debt, to an eye-opening thriller that will leave you feeling like Neo in The Matrix. In Web of Debt, the mysterious and often shocking origins of today's ultimate financial crisis are exposed, starting with its distant beginnings to its present disastrous climax, as the reader is shown that the way to restore America's true wealth has been with us all along. Please visit Ellen Brown's website, webofdebt.com, to see how America's money and future can become by and for the people once again.
We teach them how to tie their shoes. They teach us how to live our lives. We teach them long division. They teach us how to bank online. Our children will always outgrow us. But for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children aged 6 to 11 has doubled. The percent of overweight teenagers tripled. Obesity kills. Heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, all are linked to obesity, a problem that could be greatly reduced just by having a place to exercise. Right now, people are working hard to put parks and playgrounds where children live, where children will use them. Finding out how you can help is as easy as tying your shoes. Log on to earthshare.org now, a public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact the world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me. One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city wall, by the relief on the fast as summer people.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the People Speak Radio. Our guest tonight is Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb, one of the first female rabbis in the Jewish religion. Very nice having you with us, Rabbi Lynn.
Shukran, thank you.
You know, we were talking on break. We were talking about the weight that is had by peace activists all over the world when, in light of imminent what we see as imminent wars and wars, upcoming wars. The other thing that we were discussing was how does one defend? You love Israel. That I can tell. That I hear in your voice that you have said. How does one defend a nation against wrong and feel righteous?
Well, I'm not in the business of defending a nation against wrong. I think what we have to do is name what is wrong in order for us to move toward coexistence. Jews and Palestinians' fate is intimately tied together. We live next to each other. We're neighbors. And at the moment, Israel is being a very bad neighbor to Palestinians. That's rather an understatement, you know, and I cannot justify that behavior, and I think it needs to change, and I'm doing everything in my power to try to contribute to that change. I believe people ask me if I believe in a one state or two state or, you know, what the end will be. And what I can say is that I believe Palestinians will struggle for their freedom, and that the two state solution is looking less and less possible, which means that the nature of that struggle will take on a different form. So, you know, Palestinians are my brothers and sisters. They're my friends, my relatives. You know, I can't stand seeing what's happening to them. It's horrible. So I have lots of friends and Jewish friends in Israel as well, and I worry for them as well and love them as well. And this is a very painful, very terrible situation that is, you know, unless the Jewish community embraces nonviolence and repudiates militarism and repudiates it. Hello?
Yes.
Hello? And repudiates the course that we've been taking, we are harming our own community.
President Obama has made the statement that he is going to continue the talks at Annapolis. He's going to be relentless when it comes to the peace talks or the peace process. I really have come to abhor the term peace process because so far the peace process has brought nothing but misery and suffering to the people of Palestine and to the, a lot of good people in Israel too. How do you feel? But you know, in actuality, I have not seen anything substantial coming from the Obama administration. Obviously, it's only been a little over 100 days. But what are your thoughts on the Obama situation in this regards to this?
Remains to be seen.
Mm.
I think it's too early to tell. I think that, you know, we'll see if, for instance, there's a demand for a freeze of settlements that is backed with some withholding of aid. There has to be some kind of serious demonstration of commitment to the end of the process of settlement expansion. We also have to see an opening of the borders of Gaza the end of the siege immediately. I mean, people, all the houses that were destroyed, people can't even, they can't even get one bag of cement is worth $50 that's brought in through the tunnels. I mean, this people of Gaza need so much assistance, and we have to see that happen and through U.S. pressure. Then we'll have a sense of how serious the administration is.
We have a caller, Rabbi Lynn. Mike from California. Mike, your question for the rabbi?
Yes, hello. First of all, Rabbi Gottlieb, you are a very, very sensitive, sounding, and caring person. It's a pleasure to hear you, especially a rabbi, speak on this topic of Israel and Palestine. And I was wondering if you had considered going to Gaza on the ship sponsored by FreeGaza.org, along with others like Cindy Sheehan and George Galloway, Roseanne Barr. I think your presence on that journey might have some kind of a, you know, effect as far as showing the rest of the world.
Well, hi, and yes, I have considered going. I'm working for the American Friends Service Committee as a Middle East Program Associate with Nora Khoury, so most of my time is spent on these days on this issue, and I would like to go to Gaza. Whether by ship, I'm not sure, because I get really, really seasick. I do not travel well on the waters, but But I would like to make an effort to journey to Gaza. And there are several delegations going over the next months. And I have been to Gaza in the past as well. I would like to go again, yes.
Mm. We have a question from Fred in Western Canada in text.
Okay.
And Fred asks, what are your opinions on Jewish victimhood as a cultural foundation?
Well, I don't think victimhood is a good foundation for anyone. It's not a good foundation for people who have survived violence, and whether it's domestic violence, sexual abuse, which has been a lot of my work, or whether it's genocide or extremely brutal social conditions, thinking of victimhood is not great for the process of healing. And what it means to be empowered and how to heal from cultural trauma and historical trauma is a topic which many people are from a variety of traumatized communities are considering. So I think I understand the question, and I've liked to think about what it means to heal from cultural trauma and cultural regeneration, preservation of language, affirmation of self. All of these things are very positive, but obviously not at the expense of a whole other people.
Thank you. Mr. Wheat from Australia, this is going to be our last question. We're going to have to wrap this up, but I wanted to get this last question in. I was wondering what a rabbi does as part of their job on a daily basis.
Well, one hears a lot of questions about Jewish tradition. You might be performing ceremonies, births, weddings, doing bar mitzvah preparation, teaching classes, visiting people in the hospital. I think my own practice is a bit unusual in that I'm able, privileged to spend so much time working for peace. And those of you who are interested in Jewish nonviolence can check out shomershalom.org, S-H-O-M-E-R, shalom.org. Which is a network of Jews committed to nonviolence. It's an interesting and very fulfilling occupation.
Well, that's wonderful. I'll tell you what, Rabbi, this has just been a real pleasure and a real honor talking to you. I really appreciate you. If nobody has said that to you in a long time, I'm saying it right now. Thank you for joining us tonight on The People Speak. We hope to have you back with us at a future date, Rabbi. Here I am trying to get you to commit right now.
Well, thank you so much. And my condolences and apologies go out to all Palestinians who have suffered so greatly in recent months, and to those in Israel and Sderot and in other parts of the country. We pray for peace and well-being for all of our children.
Well, thank you. I hold my hand out to you in solidarity. Thank you again. And ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth NASA astronaut to step on the moon, will be, and the founder of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, will be our guest next Tuesday night. And thank you again, Rabbi Lynn. You have a great night. Good night, everybody. We'll see you until then. Let the people speak.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea wall by the relief of death, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest, to the stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.
You were listening to The Peaceful Planet synthesized from spirit through the mediumship of Robert Murray. Listen in to The Peaceful Planet every Saturday at 12 noon Central to music from the angelic realms, including inspired songs from John Lennon.